Former Yale professor William Derezowitz wants parents to think before sending their kids to the country's most elite colleges. In a scathing takedown of Ivy League schools and other elite institutions, in an essay for The New Republic, Derezowitz wrote that the overall system exacerbates inequality and retards social mobility. It also perpetuates an elite that is isolated from the society it is supposed to lead. The IVC says turns kids into zombies instead of teaching them to be creative, thoughtful citizens. Derezowitz's detractors call his claims misguided, even destructive. So what's the true value of an elite education? And what's a parent to do? We'll debate that next on Midday, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. The Ivy League is comprised of Brown, Columbia, Cornell, Dartmouth, Harvard, Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, or Penn, and Yale. These eight schools are considered the best of the best in the United States and are some of the most selective in the world. For applicants to the class of 2018, the Ivies had an average acceptance rate of less than 9%. These are the high-status schools that parents of bright students and bright students consider paragons. Make it in those schools and you can make it in America. But it is Ivy exclusivity a sign of academic excellence or simply a reflection of an ongoing elitist class structure? In a scathing essay for The New Republic over the summer, former Yale University professor William Derezowitz pushes back on the assumption that the Ivy League is a model of academic excellence. Instead, he writes that these schools are producing zombies instead of thoughtful, creative leaders, and that the system exacerbates inequality, retards social mobility, perpetuates privilege, and creates an elite that is isolated from the society it's supposed to lead. What's more, he feels that the admissions process is rigged to cater to high-achieving, SAT-tested children of the upper-middle class. And once admitted, these students' relentless drive for perfection undermines the meaningful learning experiences that an undergraduate education is meant to offer. William Derezowitz's essay was adapted, the essay was adapted from his book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite. That book is out this summer. And so we thought we'd take this opportunity to follow up on an essay that really provoked lots of discussion. I would say it went viral on the internet. Lots of people were talking about it over the summer, and there's been some follow-up. There was a rebuttal published in The New Republic, and the author of that piece, Josh Chapman, an Ivy League graduate, will be joining us during this hour to talk things over, and we'll get his point of view as well. But I want to start with William Derezowitz, and thank you for joining us here on Midday.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm going to read something here and to get us started. Our system of elite education manufactures young people who are smart and talented and driven, yes, but also anxious, timid, and lost, with little intellectual curiosity and a stunted sense of purpose, trapped in a bubble of privilege, heading meekly in the same direction, great at what they're doing, but with no idea why they're doing it. And William Derezowitz, you spent some time, of course, in the Ivy League teaching, and you were there for quite a while before this became apparent and clear to you.
Well, it gradually, I would say, became clear over the 10 years that I taught at Yale. Mm-hmm. I had also spent a lot of time at Columbia, including 5 years as a graduate instructor. You know, like I said, speaking with students, observing my students, speaking with colleagues, reflecting on my own experience, I started to understand a little more deeply what was going on with the students I was teaching. 6 years ago, I published an essay that went viral very quickly. And since then, I've heard from many, many, many students. I've been to selective campuses around the country, because I should say that this is not just about the Ivy League. I think that's sort of been the headline. That's the way The New Republic titled the piece. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the system of elite college education in general. It comprises many dozens of schools. And more importantly, it's not just about college. It's also about what happens before you get to college. It's also about what choices you make as you leave college, after college. So, I've been thinking about this for a long, long time, and it's been 6 years since that original piece came out. And the response has told me that there are a lot of people who recognize the validity of my critique. I mean, I got hundreds of emails from students. I continue to get many, many emails, more every day. And most of them say some version of, thank you for putting my experience into words, or thank you for saying out loud what I've been saying privately for a long time. So I think there's a real need to speak about these things.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the part that resonates with me, the reason I'm glad you wrote what you did is just to get people to think about why we do this to begin with. What is the college track all about? We emphasize, you know, college education. It doesn't have to be the Ivies, like you say. It can be any of these elite schools. We think, you know, go to the best school that'll have you. You want to be at the best school, but why? The question is why, and what is the purpose of it all anyway?
Right, that's a perfect question. Right, I mean, in Baltimore, you have Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, UVA. Mm-hmm. There's schools around the country like this, and people assume that. I mean, it's become like Consumer Reports. They see the list in U.S. News. They assume that the more highly ranked a school, the better it is. They assume that, therefore, they should go to that school, that that's going to be the best choice for them. And those are really questionable assumptions. I mean, what does best mean? U.S. News basically ranks prestige. And maybe even more to the point, it ranks market position or institutional wealth. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a more highly ranked school is going to give you a better education. What are they teaching for? What are their professors paying attention to? Is it teaching or is it their own research? How likely are you to encounter a professor in the classroom? What are the students around you going to be like? Are they really going to be intellectually curious? Or are they going to be sort of intensely competitive, pre-professional, careerist, and kind of blinkered? These are the questions that individuals' families need to ask, and I think they're questions that we all need to ask.
You know, we just had a program with Kim Clark from Money Magazine. Kim Clark, who's a higher education finance expert, writes for Money Magazine. And their survey was based almost exclusively on what your earnings will be 5 years out of college. That's how they came up with their rankings. So even more to that point.
Yeah, although, I mean, listen, I want us to get away from thinking of college just in terms of how much you're going to earn. But for the record... There's a very well-researched study that found that for most kids, not for all kids, and I suspect your second guest is going to talk about those other kids, but for most kids, it actually doesn't matter where you go to college in terms of your future earnings. What matters is who you are. So, yes, some schools may have higher average earnings than other schools, but for the if you match individual kids, kids who could have gone to a prestigious private school but for one reason or another chose to go to a less prestigious public university, their future earnings are the same because it's you that matters.
Right. And getting to the you, okay, that takes me to this other quote I wanted to read. College is not the only chance to learn to think, but it is the best chance. One thing is certain. If you haven't started by the time you finish your BA, there's little likelihood you'll do it later. That is why an undergraduate experience devoted exclusively to career preparation is 4 years largely wasted. You state here, learning how to think, that's what college should be about.
Yeah, I think that is what college should be about. That means learning to think in sort of a rigorous, analytical way, mm-hmm. sifting arguments, making your own arguments. But it also means learning to think about yourself. It means learning to become the kind of self-reflective adult that's going to be able to make self-directed choices in life, rather than continuing to follow the social herd, do what your parents told you, do what society seems to expect of you.
What did you see at Yale in that regard?
Well, I want to say, first of all, I saw a lot of great kids. I really love teaching there. They are smart kids. They are often curious. They're certainly good kids. But the system was serving them very badly and was pushing them in very pre-professional kinds of directions. And the relatively few kids I saw who really were burning with a more vibrant intellectual curiosity, who really wanted to get sort of a genuine education in the most open-ended sense possible, felt that the institution was failing them, they would come to me and say, I feel out of place here. Everyone is running around doing a million extracurriculars. Everyone's talking about the internship they're going to get next summer. Everyone's talking about the job they're going to get after graduation. And I really want to, I'm here for something larger, for something deeper. And they had a lot of trouble figuring out whom to turn to for that kind of guidance.
Yeah. You know, we mentioned that you got provoked quite a response with the excerpt that appeared in the New Republic in July. On the positive side, you would say, yeah, a lot of affirmation. People said, I'm so glad you stated this. This is how I felt. On the other side, what did you hear, though? Because I've noticed that you've since written an essay about the response.
Right. And I should say that, you know, the book Excellent Sheep came out a month after the excerpt. It came out about a month and a half ago, and it's continued to generate this kind of response. Listen, there's a lot of personal attacks, a lot of defensiveness, a lot of people saying that this is all just sour grapes or sort of personal motives. A lot of the responses come from people who are still in college and I think lack the perspective to understand what they might be missing from their education, have only the experience of themselves and their friends to go on, and aren't drawing from a wider pool of understanding. But, you know, I actually just did a tour of mostly Ivy League campuses.
I heard that.
And listen, in most places, we had very good, productive discussions. I mean, the kids pack the rooms. They really want to talk about this. I think that they are a little wary of me. I think there's an initial sort of resistance or, you know, sort of pushback. And once we get through that, we sort of have to pass through those emotions. After a few minutes, they see that I'm human. They see that I think that they're human, that I'm coming from a good place, and that I'm responding to things that they themselves have really been hungry to talk about. And they end up being, you know, really great. They end up being like 2-hour advising sessions where kids are really asking for guidance, the kind of guidance that they're often not getting. I will say that the one really awful event was at Harvard, where there was a panel of deans and senior professors, and they just attacked me. You know, it was just this incredible sort of defensive hostility that amounted to, we don't have any of these problems at Harvard, and we're working very hard to deal with them. It was this really kind of contradictory message.
Wow. I mean, the information I get, the comments I get from professors off the record is actually in agreement with yours about the inability of young people, young adults to think that many of them, the brightest ones, are coming in with, you know, high SAT scores and they've achieved well through high school, but they're on track and it's hard to get them to use their imaginations to think, as you say. I hear that a lot from professors off the record.
It's funny that it's always off the record.
Yeah.
There's a great reluctance to criticize the institutions in public. But yes, I've heard, I should say, not only from students over the years, but from many, many professors. And I want to emphasize that it's not just the colleges or even mainly the colleges that are the problem. It's the admissions process that the colleges have evolved, have created, and what that requires of kids, who it requires them to become by the time they get to college. You know, it turns them into hoop jumpers, right? I mean, we all know this, the sort of insane sort of high school experience that kids have, especially in, you know, upper middle class, suburban, affluent, whatever, high-achieving backgrounds. And the problem is that colleges don't do much to disrupt the momentum of that. And really, I mean, there may be a speech from the, you know, the dean at the beginning, you know, when you get there, like, think about the big questions, you know. But, against the momentum of the culture, including the student culture, those kinds of exhortations don't matter very much.
I want to just run something by you here before our first break. I wonder, when you speak to these students on your tour with Excellent Sheep, your book, do they understand what you mean about thinking? Do they understand what you mean about that? Because for whatever reason, because they're worried about the future, there's a lack of confidence that they'll be able to live as well as their parents, for instance. Or maybe they've, you know, had the talk with dad or mom about getting on track early. or they've seen friends who came out of college and did well, found a job right away, and you know, in the financial sector, as so many Princeton graduates seem to be headed towards, becoming hedge fund directors. So they see all that. So there's all that pressure. So you can't really waste a lot of time in at Harvard, wherever you go, you know, studying philosophy or studying film or something like that. You need to get focused. You need to get on track.
Right. Well, let me say a couple of things. I mean, it's really important to emphasize that this is not something that started after the financial collapse in 2008. This is something, I mean, when I originally wrote the first essay, it was actually in 2007 when we were still riding high. This is the result of decades of what we call the meritocracy. People have been talking about this for a long time. So this is not about the greater sort of financial challenges now.
Okay.
Some students respond exactly the way you're saying. I think many others have an inkling that there may be something more to their education and are very eager to have some kind of moral support, some kind of permission to pursue what they really care about. And the thing that I really try to say, and I say this in the book, and I say this on campuses, is that it's not either or. If you're going to have a successful career, it's going to be important for you to pursue something that's really meaningful to you, because you're going to be better at it if you do that. We can't all be computer programmers or engineers. We're not all equipped to do it. There aren't enough jobs for all of us to do it. It's better to do something that you're really great at, which tends to be the thing you really care about, than something that may be more lucrative in general, but if you're mediocre at it, you're not going to be successful. So to me, you know, developing a self, becoming an adult in college is actually a very practical thing to do, because it's going to help you make very practical, tangible choices in life.
We have to take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more with William Derizowitz, author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. His the excerpt from that book that was published in the New Republic over the summer set off, well, quite a debate, and we'll actually engage that debate after this short break. A little more information about our guest in this hour of the show, William Derizowitz. As he mentioned, he was a professor at Yale until 2008, and a couple of earlier essays that he wrote were really, people talked about them a great deal. I remember The Disadvantages of an Elite Education, another one, Solitude and Leadership, and he does frequent speaking on college campuses. As you can see, and I guess you can see why, given the nature of what he's been writing about and talking about for a while. He's a contributing writer for The Nation, a contributing editor for The New Republic, where his essay on the Ivy League appeared, and author earlier of A Jane Austen Education, How Six Novels Taught Me About Love, Friendship, and the Things That Really Matter. So that's William Derizowitz, and we thank you again for being with us. And okay. Something else I wanted to mention to you before we introduce our next guest, and that is years ago, this is sort of a personal story, but one can become self-conscious of not having gone to the Ivy League or not having gone to an elite school, not having gone to a college that people recognize when you mention it or wear it on a T-shirt, right? And you think, well, you know, I did the best I could. This is all I could afford, all my parents could afford. And back in the time I'm talking about, Bill, I'm going to call you Bill the rest of the show, if that's all right.
Please do.
The guidance counselor at my school wasn't really hip to, you know, a lot of things. This is like 40 years ago now I'm talking about, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. And my parents hadn't gone to college, and I didn't really get a lot of very good guidance there. So I did the best I could. I went to I went out of state, and I thought I got a good education. And I remember other kids feeling the same way in college and thinking, we went to kind of an inferior school. Yale's up the road. None of us are going to Yale. But we thought, we're going to make the best of it. And that became a sort of a recurring theme when we had these discussions, that maybe you've heard other kids say this, other college students say, well, it is what you make it, right? Go find the best professors, find the best classes. You got to work at it a little bit. It's not going to all be handed to you. It's not the greatest school. You might have a dull class here and there. You might have a really bust of a teacher one semester, but make up for it in the next one and make the best of it. Does that resonate with you? Do you hear other kids say that?
Yeah, sure. But one of the places that I hear kids say that is at Yale.
Is it Yale?
No, I mean, this is really important.
Yeah,
this
is really important. It is.
Students at selective schools, I'm not going to say this is true everywhere. I think in some ways it's more true. They have to fight to get the kind of good education we're talking about because the system isn't set up to help them get it. One of the big issues is that the more prestigious a school, the more it tends to be focused on the quality of its research. And it's choosing and rewarding professors based on their scholarship, on their research. Every second spent on teaching, every second spent with a student, every extra second is a second taken away from that research. So there's strong incentives away from being involved with your students. That's a really big issue. That's one reason why the type of college that I sort of most advocate for in the book is the small liberal arts college. But there are also a lot of public honors colleges that reproduce the environment of a small liberal arts college on big public campuses. There are several dozen of those now, because those are institutions that are much more focused on teaching. So it's ironic that you say that about your situation, because I think it's so true. And it's part of the myth about the more prestigious the school, the better the school is.
Thank you very much for that. Bill Derizowitz, with us for the remainder of the hour, the author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Now, J.D. Chapman is joining us, Josh Chapman, a Yale graduate. He wrote a response to Bill's essay in The New Republic. So let's get him on the line with us and hear from J.D. Chapman. Thank you for joining us on the Midday Show.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Bill. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine, Josh. So your response that was published in The New Republic was send your kid to the Ivy League, just the opposite of what Bill had to say. So let's hear from you, Josh. What did you object to about Bill's take?
Sure. Well, there are a couple specific things, but if it's okay with you, I'd like to start off just pointing out I suspect that Bill didn't write his headline, and neither did I.
Right,
I
okay.
There's probably a significant amount of overlap in our views, and I agree with a lot of what he's had to say today. There are some things that I think we disagree about, and I think those are mostly a matter of our relative professional perspectives coming into this discussion. I mean, you got two Ivy League guys who are essentially wringing their hands about the quality of Ivy League and peer institutions, and so I think. That in and of itself, I think, is a kind of a funny discussion. But that leads me to pointing out something, which is that one of the things that I agree with Bill about a lot is that education shouldn't be primarily about a pre-professional track. For one thing, because people aren't likely to stay in the same profession their entire lives. So just from a practical perspective, you want to prepare people who are facile and intellectual enough that they can make adjustments as the economy changes. But one of the things, and I'm not championing this and saying so, I just am acknowledging a basic truth, which is that for folks who are from other geographical locations rather than elite suburbs, whose families don't come from that kind of background, the imprimatur of an education of a premier institution can make a difference, even if they don't use it very well while they're there, for the rest of their lives. And having gone to a place, you know, that has an international reputation can make a big difference for them. And that has nothing to do with the quality of the education, nor am I particularly happy about that fact in America, but it's still true. And I think it's something that needs to be part of the conversation in terms of the value of the degree, not the education itself.
Okay, okay. Bill, sort of, Bill Derizowitz, sort of hard to disagree with that.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, as I said before, there's a study that says that for most kids, right?
It doesn't matter.
Typical middle class or upper middle class white kid, it does matter for students of color and lower income students. And I would never tell students not to go to an Ivy League school for that reason. It's absolutely true. But we need to remember that very, very few of those kids get to Ivy League type schools. And the reason is precisely because the system is also reinforcing class segregation. Precisely because the admissions process is so arduous now, it requires an enormous amount of family resources to create the kind of kid who can get through that very narrow, I think you said 9% little eye of the needle. And as a result, there's an enormous socioeconomic segregation, stratification on these campuses. So to say, yes, if you are one of the, I don't know, 100 lower-income kids who get into Harvard every year, yeah, you should go. But let's not forget that this is a system that, in general, makes it very, very hard for lower-income kids to go to high-status schools. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with the narrow point that if you're someone who got in, you should very strongly consider going.
Mm-hmm. Josh, did you want to add anything else?
Yeah, well, I would. I mean, I don't disagree with him about that, although I think the statistic is probably I think it's probably better than that. But I which is that the small liberal arts colleges, which Bill champions and which I agree with him about, far more of my students go to those kinds of schools than the kinds of schools that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Very widely in terms of their ability to embrace and intentionally seek out the kinds of students that we are just now talking about as well. That some of the same competitive standards and the enormous allocation of resources required to create those kinds of transcripts, which is not to say those kinds of students, impact admission at schools. And I don't usually like to talk about colleges in terms of tiers because I share with Bill a disdain for U.S. News and World Report ranking kind of ways of thinking about schools. But even schools that are two or three tiers down often have the exact same problem but don't have the financial resources to make admission possible. A lot of those liberal arts colleges suffer from the same problem in terms of unintentionally privileging folks from the same background because they don't have the same financial aid resources and because they have some of the same problems with their admissions offices.
Well, I was just going to raise the issue of the increasing cost of education. Now, I understand some of the elite schools we're talking about can do more, have more resources to help students with financial aid. But is this pressure, which goes back now several years before the economic downturn and the recession, the pressure that parents and students feel because they're taking on so much debt for an education that there's got to be a payoff? That's why there's more focus on a payoff. Bill, maybe you want to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are things that have been developing for a very long time, and the focus on college as vocational training exclusively actually precedes even the run-up in student debt, which you're right, is older than just 6 years old. But again, you know, it's not that simple. I mean, if you're a low-income kid who gets a full scholarship from Harvard, go. The fact remains, you talked about statistics, 3-4% of kids at selective colleges come from the bottom quarter of the income distribution, 3-4%, and maybe 15% come from the bottom half of the income distribution. And the more prestigious the school, the more stratified it tends to be. A lot of the liberal arts colleges are also very good at offering scholarships. But it's also even more complicated than that because most kids go to public universities. Most public universities have lower tuitions. Of course, it will depend on the individual student and the kind of aid package they can get. But the fact is, I've also heard from a lot of poor kids who end up at elite schools who say that they feel really socially out of step, really alienated. These schools are often not so great at integrating kids who don't have the same kinds of educational backgrounds. And it may be, actually, that a large public university, for all the downsides of that kind of education, can do a much better job because they're much more used to dealing with kids from disadvantaged backgrounds. They're a much larger percentage of their population. So again, it's not clear at all that the richer the school, the better it's going to be helping disadvantaged kids.
Bill and Josh, I want you to hold on there. We want to take a couple of calls here before our next break, and if you want to respond, please do, okay? This is Curtis in Baltimore joining us on Midday. Curtis, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Listening in very self-interestedly because I have a daughter who's a senior right now, and we're looking for colleges. She's a very good student. We are upper middle class, and this is a debate that's raging through our household right now. And I must say, we're looking at a lot of elite colleges. One question I have, you may just be giving a critique, not sort of practical advice, but if the elite college is not the right choice, is the large state university a better choice? It seems to me like that's an even more careerist environment where you have kids going to school, you have a lot more business majors, engineers, hotel motel management. They go into school looking at what job they're going to get coming out. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking about learning to think. Mm-hmm. And for a child that you want to have that sort of enriched environment, is the public institution a better option than one of these more elite schools?
Well, again, this is why I make a distinction between elite universities and elite liberal arts colleges. And Josh is right. The other guest is right. Elite liberal arts colleges are often, socioeconomically elite as well for many of the same reasons. But at least I think they have a different way of looking at their educational mission. And that's also why I talk about the honors colleges, which are both small liberal arts colleges and public institutions. They're small, subsets of large public campuses that sort of split the difference between the two. I agree with you that large public universities are not necessarily great educational environments, although I will say that if you aren't one of those vocationally minded kids, or if you're not majoring in beer, or if you're not in a fraternity and you're really taking your studies seriously, then those places can actually be very good because you have the kind of access to professors. Professors there are really actually hungry for intellectually curious, academically serious kids. And in some ways, it's easier to stand out and it's easier to develop relationships with professors, mm-hmm. even though you think it might not be because it's such a large campus.
Josh, did you want to add something?
I would concur with almost everything that Bill just said, especially the last point, which is that often for kids who are really academically gifted, being in a school where they are more likely to stand out sometimes provides them more opportunities. I would add, too, though, in addition to talking about honors colleges within large state universities, that it's even harder, I think, to generalize about state universities than it is to generalize about small liberal arts colleges. In the state where I live, I'm a little to the south of you guys, in Virginia, for example. The nature of the student body and the admissions office and everything else at UVA is radically different from Radford, is radically different from JMU, is radically different from Longwood or William and Mary. They have different cultures, and there are different cultures on the campuses. Relative access to faculties is different, too. So there are colleges that replicate the kinds of things that you're talking about. Sometimes within an individual major, it's different as well. So that makes it harder for the caller, I think, to distinguish. But I think state universities can be a great option. I will say, though, and I think this is pretty common in my experience, which is that a lot of families who are on the upper end of the middle class spectrum, not necessarily the wealthiest families who don't need to worry about one way or the other, or the poorest kids, tend to end up with lower bills at whatever the sticker price is at a private liberal arts college. The cost of a state university is often higher because the financial aid packages are often not commensurate. Hmm.
J.D. Chapman or Josh Chapman, I thank you for being with us today. Mm-hmm. You're the academic director of an independent high school in Virginia, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a community high school in Roanoke.
In Roanoke. And your essay, Send Your Kid to the Ivy League, the rebuttal to William Dershowitz's piece in the New Republic, and now, of course, excerpted from his book, Excellent Sheep, can be found on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, a link to it if you haven't had a chance to read it. It was published in July. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, and thanks, Bill.
Thank you. And Bill Dershowitz, please stay there. We're going to take a break.
Sure.
We'll come back and talk some more and take some more phone calls from our listeners here. William Dershowitz's book, The Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life, excerpt of that appeared in the New Republic over the summer with that headline, "Don't send your kids to the Ivy League." If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. I taught many wonderful young people during my years in the Ivy League, bright, thoughtful, creative kids whom it was a pleasure to talk with and learn from, but most of them seemed content to color within the lines that their education had marked out for them. Very few were passionate about ideas. Very few saw college as part of a larger project of intellectual discovery and development. Everyone dressed as if they were ready to be interviewed at a moment's notice. An excerpt, again, from the essay adapted from William Derizowitz's book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Let's go take some more calls, Bill, and then you can respond to our listeners.
Sure.
This is Lorenzo in Joppatown, Maryland. Thank you for calling Midday.
Hey, how are you today?
Okay, thank you for calling, Lorenzo.
Awesome show as usual, Dan.
Thank you.
I wanted to make two points. First of all, Josh made a point earlier about how an Ivy League education can, what it can do for a family who is not necessarily in the upper class, a family who's not necessarily from the elite part of society. I mean, I'm African American, and I come from a very working class family, and we were lucky enough and to have a cousin, my first cousin, who got a scholarship to Princeton, attended Princeton, graduated, and then went on to NYU Law School. I personally didn't go to college. I'm a 54-year-old college senior right now, as a matter of fact. I'm finishing up college at my age, even though I don't have to. I've been very successful. I own my own business. I do really well. But I decided, because I have the time, I'll go back and finish my college. My point is that my cousin that went to Princeton, it inspired our entire family. You understand? We come from a very challenged background, and it inspired everyone. It inspired me to believe I can be an elite even without going to college. It inspired all the young ladies and all the young men in my family that, you know what, we can do and be anything we want to. So there's sort of an intangible that we need to think about. No disrespect to Bill. Having this conversation about, you know, how the quality of education in Ivy League schools, having this conversation between folks who maybe it's easier for them to attend that school, it's a different viewpoint from someone who doesn't have family members who have ever done it in the past. If you're the first family member to do that, you don't really concentrate too much on the quality of education. The fact that you got Princeton there, I mean, it does something for the whole family. That's my point.
Yeah. What do you want to say about that,
I mean,
Bill? I mean, I get Lorenzo's point, but he says the quality doesn't matter as much as prestige in this case, right?
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
What he's saying.
Listen, first of all, I want to say congratulations to Lorenzo for finishing his BA at the age of 55. I really think that's great. And he probably has much more perspective on what this is about than a 20-year-old. Look, I mean, obviously he's right. Unfortunately, it's becoming only about the prestige to the exclusion of the education. But let me also say something about the kinds of families that I think Lorenzo is coming from and talking about, because I've heard this a lot, and counselors will tell you this. Everybody's heard of the Ivy League. Everyone's aspiring to the Ivy League. But it's often the case that when a kid like that can't get to the Ivy League, they just go to a public college down the road. So it's either the Ivy League, because everyone's heard of them, or it's sort of the local public universities, because you've heard of those. And what goes missing from that is that there are a lot of other really good schools, and they may be liberal arts colleges, they may be public universities in other parts of the country. There are lots of colleges in this country that students like that can aspire to. Now, granted, maybe Princeton, in terms of inspiring the whole family, would be the best. But what I'm saying is also our worship of the Ivy League is actually, in some ways, reducing the conception of opportunity that a lot of lower income or people of color have about what might be possible for them. They don't know, hey, you could go to a Bowdoin, you could go to a Johns Hopkins, you could go to UVA even if you don't come from Virginia. So in some ways, you know, the prestige game can create all kinds of unintended effects.
Here's an email from Peggy, a teacher. She says, as someone who has taught at both the secondary and university levels, I want to thank Bill for this, his attention to this subject and this conversation today. I can attest to the existence of the insane high school focus on what comes next. The frenzy even begins in middle school years where, in the school in which I recently taught, seventh graders were subjected to midterm exams with the purpose of, quote, preparing the students early for their eighth grade exams, which in turn were to prepare them for the eventual college entrance exams. Teachers were required to prepare review materials to spend the week before the midterms preparing for them. No homework was allowed during that time. Forget about the momentum of the class and a focus on learning. What a poor message to give those 12 to 13-year-olds, and what a waste of important learning time.
Yeah, I mean, wow. Listen, yeah, did you want to ask a question?
No, I just wondered what your response was to that. I hate to be a teacher in that situation, but what is going on there in our schools? We haven't spent a lot of time talking with you, Bill, about what goes on before college with parents and with teachers, with the schools.
Right. Yeah. Listen, I mean, this is a pervasive and really destructive philosophy in American education now. It's about a narrow measurements of results. It's about school is exclusively the purpose, not even just of career or vocation, but of getting you your first job after college, which even Josh, the other guest, said is a really narrow way to look at, even in vocational terms. It's about preparing students like Peggy said, for the next thing, which is for the next thing, which is for the next thing, which is for the next thing. And that's what I saw in my college students, right? What's the next thing? What's the next hoop that I should jump through? Tell me what to do next. Because there's never been an opportunity to think about what education is for, or as Peggy, I think, was saying, to kind of be in the moment with what you're learning now and explore the richness of it, the depth of it, the beauty of it. You know, I mean, I've heard from math teachers who said, you know, I try to show students that math is beautiful, because it's all just about passing the test or acing the test, which is, go ahead.
Let's take another call. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. And thank you, Peggy. Here's Angelo in Severna Park. Thanks for holding, Angelo.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I've had this experience myself with my daughter. She is a graduate of Harvard, undergraduate, and her experience there was nothing short than amazing. From her perspective, she was a top student, but also an artist. She was a singer, an opera singer. And, you know, when we got there, they made it pretty clear that one of the reasons that they brought her there was that not only was she a top student, but that she brought something else, that she was passionate about something else and brought that to the table and was looking forward to her being involved in all the art. And she actually started out planning on graduating with a music degree. And halfway through, and this kind of gets to the what was being talked about, is kind of this herd and sheep mentality thing that we've been talking about. That wasn't our experience at all at Harvard undergrad. The classes, there's no such thing at Harvard as like a Chem 101 class. It's chemistry and something else. All the classes are cross-disciplined and integrated. And they're really meant to engage the student on a multidimensional level at the undergraduate level to get them thinking about and discovering what they might be interested in. They have some innovations there that I'd never seen in any other colleges. They have the shopping week where the kids basically have like 2 weeks where they can walk in and out of classes and just try classes on to see if they like them. There's an online grading system for classes and teachers. So the teachers are basically competing to make their classes more interesting. And the students take it very seriously about, reporting into that system.
Angelo, thank you. I want to get Bill's comments here and try to get in a couple other callers. But thank you for that perspective, at least from Harvard undergrad. Bill?
Yeah. This is why I talk about the danger of people only speaking from a very narrow experience. Well, I'm glad that Angelo's daughter had a good experience at Harvard. Shopping week takes place at every college. Online grading systems for evaluation systems for professors, that's everywhere. It isn't true that all classes at Harvard are cross-disciplinary. That's very, very far from true. I would be suspicious if it were true. again, it's great that she had a great experience, but the fact is that something like 60% of Harvard students go into one of four fields when they graduate: Wall Street, consulting, law, and medicine. And that's typical at Ivy League colleges. So while there are certainly exceptions, what I'm describing is the norm. And the norm is students herding themselves en masse into very safe, very predictable careers when they get out of college.
Here's Linda in Catonsville. Linda, go right ahead.
I'm calling about a topic that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the idea of first, second, third tier schools. My daughter went to that really good Central Ohio liberal arts college that you mentioned in your book. It starts with a K. but she had some friends who were really, really smart kids, but they didn't have the spit and polish, finely honed resume or transcript. So they didn't go to flashy schools, but these kids never quit being smart, and they ended up being successful. What about the smart student who just doesn't get that grooming beforehand? They still turn out to be smart kids. Mm-hmm. I'll just get off.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah.
Well, I actually prefer those kinds of students, and I think that I think it's a blessing not to have that kind of grooming, because what gets groomed out of you often enough is independence of mind, intellectual curiosity, sort of that resistant or resilient spirit that I think we look for in young people. And I think that's one of the reasons why less prestigious schools sometimes are actually offer a better education. Because it's not, they're not full of kids who got an A, who had to get an A in every class. Sometimes they said, you know what, I don't care about all my classes. I care about really immersing myself in the things that are important to me.
You know, your book and what you write about here, this isn't just about the Ivy League. And I'm glad you started off by saying that at the beginning here. And I picked up on that, having read your essay and notes on your book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. There's messages in here for high school students, for their teachers, for the people who run our public and private schools out here in Maryland, and for parents as well. So thank
you very much,
Bill. If you come to Baltimore, please stop in and see us, will you?
I will.
And we don't have an Ivy League school here. We have Hopkins. So if you make the tour and you come through, please come and visit us here at WYPR.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the conversation. William Derizowitz, author of A Jane Austen Education, now with this book, Excellent Sheep. And his essay, if you want to read the short version of that from the New Republic, you can find a link to it on my Facebook page. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today and listening in and sharing questions and comments with our guests in both hours of the show. We certainly appreciate that. I hope you have a great afternoon. We'll see you again for the next edition of Midday.